Good evening and welcome to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Amy and I am an alcoholic.
Amy.
For those of you who care to join us, let's open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. The AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open, big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing step 8. Please welcome our panel this evening, Margaret and Mike. This is steps 8 and 9. Sorry about that. We're starting on page 76. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol.
My name is Margaret. I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, Margaret.
My sobriety date is September 20th, 1986. My home group is Saturday Morning Brunch Bunch, which meets on Saturday mornings at 9:30 at Old Donation Episcopal Church in Virginia Beach. I hope you all can come visit sometimes. And I read this paragraph, and a couple of words caught my attention. One thing also is in the book, I looked at where it was situated in the book, and I remember and I noticed that it's after, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And it's interesting because I did 4, 5, 6, and 7 in one day, in my first 6 months of sobriety. And it was like a weekend thing, and we just went through and did it, and I, did my inventory, told another human being, whatever. Went aside, became entirely ready, because why would I want to keep all that stuff on my fifth step? And then said the seven-step prayer, and I was done. What I didn't do was it talks about here, now we need more action. I guess maybe it didn't say immediate action, like it does after the third step. that word immediate, and or maybe my sponsor didn't push it, or maybe, I don't know why, but the 8th and 9th just kind of went on hold for a pretty long time. The list of persons I had harmed in my fourth step were the people that I had resented in my resentment list, and that drastic self-appraisal. And it says, now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past, and that we attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. The two things I noticed was that I'm repairing the damage done in the past by doing these steps and sweeping away the debris. And one thing about debris, I'm familiar with debris because I border on a hoarder. I tend to just like collect stuff and then not really notice. And it reminded me of a boss I had many years ago who left a chair in the middle of our office space one time, and then for 2 days, I mean, I just walked around it because whatever, it's not my chair. And after a couple days, he said, I can't believe it. Like, you're the manager. Why did you let this happen? You know, why didn't you move the chair out of the way? And I said, I didn't actually really notice it. I just walked around it for 2 days, and that's just how I've been. And so I was thinking of debris, sweeping away the debris, is that I couldn't see it by myself. I just don't even notice it. The things that I have done that have caused damage leave a trail, you know, this trail of ill will that I leave behind me as I'm running on self-will through my life. And a lot of times I really don't even notice. I didn't even notice this chair in the middle of the office. And I need help. And luckily, there's the fellowship and the steps. And if I have the willingness and I start getting any sense of urgency, and which I get from the last sentence, remember it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. That has pushed me at times to move forward in the steps when my self-will doesn't want to. Let's see. Running the show, or the self-will, running the show ourselves. And before, I was thinking the 8th and 9th, not getting immediately into action after doing all those steps in one day, until I was moving out of Syracuse, where most of my first 8 years of sobriety were. And I had a sense of, like, I'm moving, I'm leaving this town. Is there anything I need to do? And I sat down with my sponsor and said, I haven't really done, like, 8 and 9. And so she asked me to think about, we were sitting in a Denny's. She asked me to think about anything that came to mind right away because we were moving pretty soon. And there was one family that I had taken advantage of I lived with them on and off for a year. I ate their food. But more than that, they had a supply of wine in the basement under the pool table that they would get. They were in Pennsylvania. And this wine is, you could only get it in New York State. And so when they went to New York State, for some reason or another, a couple times a year, they would get a case of this certain wine. And then they drank it once in a while. They didn't really keep track. So I figured it was there, and I was living in the house, and it's probably sort of mine. And I would just borrow a bottle every once in a while. I had no way to replace that wine. I mean, I didn't have a car. I didn't go to New York State. There was no way I was going to be able to replace it. I kept thinking someday I'll probably put it back, and I didn't. The other thing I did was they had a daughter, an underage daughter, who I would entice to drink with me because, I mean, looking back, it justified drinking the family's wine if a family member was drinking it with me. And then it was like a hospitality thing or something. And the reality was she wasn't really a drinker, and she was 19. But she was a good sport. I mean, you know, I'd come up with some good reason or an excuse and, you know, just relax. And she didn't even really want to, but she would, and I had to. So that was I actually wrote them a letter. My sponsor helped me with that one. And that's the first real 8th step I kind of remember, and I was 8 years sober. So that's that paragraph for me. Thanks.
Thanks, Margaret.
Hi, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
Mike.
My sobriety date is May 27, 1986, and I'm a member of the Birchwood Gardens group in Virginia Beach, which meets at 7 o'clock on Sunday nights. And eighth and ninth step, the thing that was most difficult for the eighth and ninth step for me was actually the sixth step. Unlike a lot of people that breeze through the steps quickly, I was stuck on the first half of the sixth step for probably about 3 months. My sponsor kept telling me, every single time I was ready to go on, thought I was ready to go on to the seventh, he kept telling me that I coveted my character defects. And I was not ready to let them go. And he actually had me look at each one of my character defects, because what I was actually doing was saying, yeah, I have these character defects, and yeah, I want them gone, but he knew that I really wanted to keep them. And he made me put each one of them basically on a balance and look at all the sick little pleasure I get out of them versus the harm they cause me, until finally I could see that every one of them caused me more harm than any sick little pleasure that I pulled out of them. And it took a lot of going through this. I met with him many, many times before I really, really felt that I didn't want these anymore. That these were actually, these weren't all the pleasure in my life. You know, because first you're taking away the alcohol, and now you're going to take away all the rest of the fun in my life. But when I really understood that these were the harm in my, this is all the pain that's in my life. This is all of the dysfunction and pain that's in my life, then I was ready. And when I actually got into, that's why I love the part with faith without works is dead, because I didn't understand that statement. And what it was is that in the, I could say that I'm ready to have God remove all these defects of character, maybe say a prayer and say, take them away. But if I'm not really ready for it, then I'm not able to do the eighth and ninth. I'm not able to put it into action if I'm really not ready to have them removed. If I really still want those defects of character, how can I go out in the eighth and ninth step, make a list, and really be ready, earnestly ready, to make amends to these people, make amends for the harms that I've caused, when I still want to do this more, you know? And maybe not some of the nastier stuff, but a lot of it, you know, the pride, the sloth, the greed, you know, I wanted all that, all the stuff for myself. And until I was really ready, I couldn't even make that list. And then I had trouble making the list. And this is getting down more into the third paragraph, so I'm going to wait on that. But there are some people who I thought had caused me more harm, and I didn't really want to put them on the list. Some of them it was easy. I the ones like, you know, my mother and my little sister, that was fine. I was ready to make amends to them, you know. But there were some nasty people that were on my list too, and I really had to be grounded in the previous steps to have them even go on the list.
Thanks, Mike. We're continuing on page 76. Probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured. To some people, we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order. But this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that we have gone religious. In the prize ring, this would be called leading with the chin. Why lay ourselves open to being branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message. But our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. He is going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than in our talk of spiritual discoveries.
It talks about the misgivings, and also it's important for me to do things like this because it forces me to look more closely at passages that I've read many times. And this word diffident caught my attention. I have always thought, reading this book, that diffident meant like neutral, kind of not feeling passionate about something. So it doesn't mean that. I looked it up. It means uncertain, lacking in self-confidence. And I thought, well, the word self right in there, I mean, that's the whole deal with me, is waiting to do action until I have self-confidence. You know, my disease is rooted in self. That's probably the huge piece of my stalling, because honestly, the eighth and ninth step I didn't do for a long time, as I had mentioned. Somewhere in my first year, I heard somebody say, do a step a year. And I figured that seemed like it gave me some leeway, even though I had done my seventh step by my first 6 months. So the problem was, I got to my 12th year of sobriety, and I hadn't done these steps, and I started getting a little uneasy. I felt like, you know, that discomfort, that the gift of desperation, because I knew I couldn't stay sober by myself. AA, got in through AA, was keeping me sober. But I had been given, on the outside, you know, 12 years to do the steps, and I really hadn't. So it did push me to, you know, go to my sponsor, bring it up at meetings, talk about it. And I know at this point, a lot of them, honestly, I did by letter. I was living far away from any place that I ever drank. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and she, given the situations and what was going on, she thought it was better for me to do it immediately than wait until I might travel to some of these places and see these people. I remember specifically my sister, who lives in Minnesota, writing her a letter. And it talks about putting our lives in order. It's not an end in itself. Our purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. Is that the debris I had left and the hurt feelings I had left kept people from listening to me or paying attention to me, even if I had really something wonderful to share. And like at the bottom, it says, he's going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than on talk of spiritual discoveries. And the anonymity of not going into it and saying like, oh, but I found religion, or God wants me to talk to you. To be anonymous and do the right thing without having some kind of label on it about why I'm doing it. I know with this letter I wrote to my sister, there was layers and layers. I mean, she was the one, she's a year younger than I am. And when we were in high school, I was doing a lot of heavy, heavy drinking. And I had a bar behind all the hanging clothes in my closet, and you know, the shelves that used to have shoes, and I would just drink in there by myself. Like, I was 17. This is not social drinking, to, you know, go in your room and pull out your bottles and your things, your mixers, and get drunk by yourself and pass out. And her bedroom was next to mine, and the bathroom was right past her bedroom. So she frequently, I mean, if I didn't make it to the bathroom, it was in front of her door that, you know, I did my deal, I passed out or whatever. And once she found me on the front steps outside in the snow and hauled me upstairs, and she would say, something's wrong. Why are you doing this? You know, what's wrong with you? And she was very worried, and she didn't know, should she tell our parents? And she just, you know, she carried a lot. And I wasn't nice to her about it. I was mean. I was mean about her ever asking me any questions, and it went on and on and on. I mean, by this time I was in my 30s, and she, I wrote her a letter, a draft, and I brought it to my sponsor, and she, and my sponsor, this goes into the next paragraph, but she edited it a lot, because I wanted some of it to be her fault, you know, that I had to behave this way. I didn't even see I was doing it, honestly. But anyway, that's in the next paragraph, I just realized, so I will pass.
With the as far as like opening up about spirituality with the people I was making amends, some I did, some I didn't. My sisters, my mother, I did. My mother's a very spiritual woman, and you know, I discussed it with her and the changes that I wanted to make and what I was trying to do with my life, and with my sisters too. My sisters, I was 27. I had a 25-year-old sister. a 30 and 31-year-old sister who were on kind of spiritual journeys. They weren't alcoholic, but they're on spiritual journeys of their own. And they actually kind of guided me on some of the things that they had done. And it was easy to talk to them. It was, they were very, very easy to make amends to. There's some other people who, I'd like to say that I did all my amends at one time, but I actually went for the low-lying fruit, the easy ones, my sisters and my mother first, and some other relatives. And then there were some, which I'll get into in the next one, there were some of the people who were kind of more like me. And I did not discuss anything spiritual with them whatsoever. I made an apology in most cases, tried to make a living amends. That's the main thing that I tried to do it with everyone if I had the opportunity to do that. And even with them, the last amends I made, I was 28 years sober. So I held on to one for a long time. And I used the excuse that I had moved out of Syracuse when I was 7 years sober to Rochester and then down here. And it was so far away that I just kind of put it away, but it nagged at me. And I had to take care of that. It became very clear to me which ones I would open up to about the spiritual nature of it, which ones were on a journey themselves, and which ones weren't, didn't want anything to hear about it, and it would have been just leading with my chin.
Thanks, Mike. Moving on to page 77. We don't use this as an excuse for shying away from the subject of God. When it will serve any good purpose, we are willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. It may be he has done us more harm than we have done him, and though we may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret.
Okay, I'm going to return to this letter to my sister because we acquired a better attitude, still not too keen about admitting our faults. I knew my faults. I knew ways I had hurt her, taken advantage of her. I'd been mean to her. But the letter I wrote also justified and rationalized a lot of that stuff and told about things that she had done that she might want to think about. Because if we're going to get all spiritual, I'm just trying to help. You might want to look at this. And my sponsor marked it up, and it was shorter when I gave it back to her, and she marked that one up, and it got shorter and shorter. She just would point out to me, like, this isn't your part. This isn't your side of the street. You can totally stand. I honestly, to the best I can think, I really sort of thought it would be helpful if I explained to her, you know, some of her issues. And I just had to follow directions, you know, that God would take care of that part, and I just had to clean up my side of the street. The thing with that was that she wrote me a nice letter back saying, I'm so glad that you've been, you know, dealing with this stuff and you're getting better, and some other things you might want to look at are. And my sponsor had told me whenever I made amends that I needed to, the last part of the amends, is there any other way I've hurt you that you want to tell me about, because I want to be able to, you know, say I'm sorry. And that's the hardest part. And the amends I have done in person is then you sit back and let the person say, yeah, I remember this, and you know, it really hurt me when you did that, and some of it I don't remember. To just listen to that and then sincerely express sorrow. And it's lucky that this foray into the ninth step with my sister was by letter, because when I got that letter, I was hot. I couldn't believe she didn't, you know, revere me and praise me for having done this stuff, and instead was helpfully pointing out some of my stuff. And that was the part of, I was reminded of Is there anything else that you want to tell me so that I can, I want everything to be clear between us? So there was that. The other thing that I've noticed forever in this, in the book, is the part where it says, we go to him in helpful, forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. And I have it penciled in various margins of various big books. Like, I always thought, like, what's wrong with ill feeling? Like, isn't it our actions that count? Like, that's what I always thought about this whole gig, is that it's what we do, not about how we feel. So I have to honestly say, I'm still not sure why it says former ill feeling instead of former ill behavior. But there it is. I'll pass.
There's, as I mentioned earlier, there's a few people who I had some serious issues with that were, it was not just a one-way street where I was abusing them. It was, it went back and forth, and I'm just going to use one as an example, this guy Mike, and in the words of Jabba the Hutt, he was my kind of scum, and he did the same kind of stuff that I did. But he was actually probably a little worse than me, and I don't usually discuss drugs at AA meetings at all, but I gave him money for an 8-ball of Coke, and he went in this apartment, ran through the apartment, and went out the back window and took off with my money. And I found him about a few weeks later in a bar, and I saw him go into the men's room. I knew that the only guys in there knew me, and so I went into the men's room, and I was extremely violent. I boxed golden gloves. I wrestled from elementary school right through college, and I absolutely loved to fight. And I beat this guy within a thread of his life. I knew that if I killed him, I was in trouble, but anything short of that, I knew I would be okay because he had a bunch of outstanding warrants on him. And and then I took 160 of the 250 he owed me. I just took his wallet and took the money, and then this guy about a week later broke into my car and stole the stereo out of my car, and then the kids on the block told me that who it was, the rat like looking guy, so then I went after him again, and that time it got interrupted. Some police walked by, and I had to stop, and then he broke into my apartment. And which was kind of my fault because the door had broken, so I had the hinges on the outside, so all I had to do was take the pins out and swing the door open the other way. But he took all this stuff from me, and so he really at this point had done a lot. And this went back and forth during spring and summer of 85, and I didn't want to put him on my 8-step list, because he had done more to me than I had done to him. And my sponsor said that, this is where the action is here. Are you still an ultraviolent person? Are you still a thief? And I said, I'm not a thief. He took all this stuff from me. He goes, after he had taken the $250, that was gone. You stole $160 from him. You owe him $160, regardless of anything else he takes. And you need to apologize him and make amends for all the physical harm that you caused him. Otherwise, you're still going to be a violent thief, is what you're going to be. And it took me a long time to get ready for that. I had to really think about this for a long time. And I got ready to make amends, and he ended up leaving the state. So I never actually made amends to him, but I was ready to make amends. And there were similar people who I made amends to. He would have actually been easier because he would have just wanted to get out of the room as soon as he saw me. Some of these people, where it said 9 out of 10 will be surprised? I wasn't surprised. most of them just sneered at me, laughed at me, and I didn't even leave in my chin. I didn't even say I was an AA or anything else. I said I just wanted to make things right for what I had done. And most of these people, it was almost, I would say, entirely every one of these people that were like me either sneered at me, didn't want anything to do with me, or one of them actually hauled off and hit me. Only one exception, that was one of the guys that sneered at me. I ran into him in the AA meeting about a year later and we shook hands. But for the most part, regardless of what happens, I had to do that. If I didn't do that, I would be the same person I was. And I don't know if I ever went more than 2 months without hitting a person. I've never hit a person in 31 years. And that's a miracle. If you knew what I was like then and now, you know, come close. But I've never actually hit a person in 31 years.
Thanks, Mike. We're still on page 77. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply, we tell him that we will never get over drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so, never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be gratified with the result. In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we are calling upon admits his own fault, so feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we are doing and wish us well. Occasionally, they will offer assistance. It should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of his office. We have made our demonstration, done our part. It's water over the dam.
I had my most recent kind of amends from way back was a few years ago. I kept trying to stop drinking when I was in high school, and I was afraid of my drinking. I was afraid that by the time I was 17, 18, I could just see I was a train wreck, and it was scary to me. I felt like I was headed towards the edge of a cliff, and I was going to fall off the edge of the world, and there was nobody to stop me. It was kind of scary, and so I would try to stop drinking in different ways. And I chose a college. I did graduate from high school. That wasn't a guarantee, but I did. And I chose a college that was far away, California, and it's a small religious college, and it was way out in the country, and they had no drinking on campus. And I didn't know it at the time, but I see clearly, like, this will keep me safe from myself and from my disease, because I won't be able to drink, and it's really structured, and it's out in the country. And but I did manage to, and after a couple of years, I had to leave. But meanwhile, when I was there, they were expanding the campus, and they had a big grand opening of this new building. And anyway, so I still get the alumni magazine. And a few years ago, they had the 25th anniversary of this building and all these pictures. And I was there. I mean, the pictures to me were real. Like, they were current. I could name everybody. I could see everything. And all of a sudden, I started remembering that day, for one thing, and in general, how I had treated some of these people who I could see. There was a big banquet, and I was one of the servers, and we weren't supposed to drink on campus, but for this kind of thing, you know, there were cases of champagne and wine, and we were supposed to serve, and I started serving my table. I don't really remember much, actually, but I took one of the bottles and left, and I don't know who took my table. I mean, it was terrible. And a friend of mine who had, set me up for this event, I don't remember her talking to me about it, but it reminded me when I saw her picture of all the times I took advantage of her kindness. You know, she was a kind, forgiving person, a really good friend. And instead of responding in kind, I was like, great. I just used her. I mean, she had a car, and she was a really good person. And I started thinking, what a scumball, you know? She ended up taking up a lot of my responsibilities. And so I brought this magazine to my sponsor, and I said, I'm remembering so much about this college where I had 2 messy years and didn't even get to stay because I couldn't deal with life on life's terms. But she said, so it sounds like you need to make amends. And I was happy to do that. I was happy to contact her. And again, I wrote a letter. And I said, I haven't had a drink in a while, and I'm remembering, certain things, and I'm really sorry because I took advantage of you, and you were always good to me, and you always loved me, and you were always kind to me, and is there anything I can do? And she never ever answered, and so I, it's funny like that after years and years and years, there's still more, there's always still more. She did not praise me. She didn't give suggestions. She never answered at all. And that's not the only one. Being long distance with people, a lot of mine were amends that I would run by my sponsor, letter amends. So I did my demonstration and I did my part, and I have to just trust that God will use that in whatever way. And I'm open to whatever else I need to do. So I'll pass.
Favorite example of this is this one story that I have of it was a person that actually wasn't even on my eight-step list. My sponsor took her off because he says, you've been making a living amends to her. And what happened was at about 3 or 4 months sober, I had a strong resentment. It had been going on for about a year. And going back into my drinking and against this woman who I worked with, and I could not stand her, and I couldn't help but have it come out every time I was talking to my sponsor. And he said, you're going to get drunk if you have this resentment. You hold on to this resentment, you will get drunk. It's as simple as that. It's in your mind all the time. It's like a rat gnawing away at your brain. You're going to get drunk. You've got to do something about it. And he told me I had to pray for her. So I prayed for her every day for 3 weeks, and the resentment did not go down one bit, not one single bit. And he said, you've got to get over this, and you got to work on this, and work on this now. And then he said, you need to pray for understanding of her. And I didn't want to understand her. I just absolutely despise her. In fact, I don't even really know where the resentment came from. I was hired straight out of college, and she was a secretary. She came a couple years later, so I was probably 26, she was probably 24. There was a bunch of young engineers there, and the secretaries, we'd all go out and we, for drinks and stuff after work, and I was friends with her for maybe a year or so. And then one day, maybe she sneered at me, maybe I sneered at her, I don't know which, but the other reacted strongly, and it just started building. And we did everything in our power to destroy each other's careers. Everything. She would sabotage my projects, and I would complain about her and it just went back and forth. Both of us really doing nasty, nasty stuff, making up things about the other person, just to the point where nobody wanted to hear either of us say anything. Everybody in the office was angry with us, and it just kept getting worse. The last 6 months of my drinking, I just despise this woman. I came up with all these insane things that I could do to destroy her life. That was my goal, to destroy this woman's life. And I think that was her goal because she was trying to destroy my life. So I had every reason in the world to try to destroy her life. And this was going on as I'm trying to get sober. And my sponsor said, you can't, you can't stay sober with that. With that inside your head, you can't work this up. You can't do anything with that, gnawing away at your head. And so when prayer didn't work, he said, I want you to pray every day for 5 minutes. Pray for understanding of her. Pray just to be able to understand who she is and why she is the way she is. And I did that, and it didn't work. And he said, keep doing it and keep doing it. This went on for over a month. And then one day after prayer, it dawned on me that she had it pretty tough. She was a single mom. She wasn't making that much money. She had a really tough life. Other people did dislike her in the office. They disliked me too, but they kind of disliked both of us. But people gave her a hard time. She had a really, really difficult life. And then it dawned on me that my life was difficult because of my own making, because of all the crazy inside my head and my drinking and everything else. And all of a sudden I felt like a heel, that I was doing this to her, and I had this moment of clarity where I realized that she wasn't a bad person. She really wasn't a bad person. She had a tough life, and I was just making it worse. and I felt like a real heel. And I went into the office the next day, and I tried to be nice to her, and she sneered at me and acted nasty. And I'd have to keep telling myself, remember how you felt last night when you prayed. That's who she is. Not what you're seeing right now is something that's going to get you angry. And I would be calling my sponsor and talking to him every night about the things she did and stuff. And he says, you just need to, you understood her. You understood what she's like. You're just seeing the results of that person that you understand. One of God's children. She's a loving person. She's got it really tough. She's got, and I kept doing this, and it finally got so that it was a living amends, and it got so that I could take it. And it took me a long time. It took me months, but I could take her abuse and still, and at first I'd have just like a smile on my face, a fake smile, and finally I realized she's a good person. She's having a hard time. And I'm not the type of person that accepts people like that at all, but I kept at it and kept at it, and I continued to pray for her and continued to pray for her, and then she stopped acting nasty to me. She just all of a sudden just mellowed right out. And then one day, she was having trouble with someone else in the office. She came over to ask me about it. And we actually got to the point where we were not only civil, we got to be sort of friends, a little bit friends. And then in the summer of 87, I was at the Syracuse AA picnic, and she was there. She was getting sober at the same time I was. And it made me realize that when it comes to other people and their actions and stuff, I got tunnel vision. I think I know everything in the world and every thought of every other person, and I have no idea what they're thinking. And that just showed me how incredibly blind I was. And until I opened up and let God help me, then I could actually see the truth afterwards, because I've got this tunnel vision. I just see what's in front of me. My ego won't let me see any more than that. It only lets me see what it wants me to see. But that's all.
Thanks. Page 78. Most alcoholics owe money. We do not dodge our creditors. Telling them what we are trying to do, we make no bones about our drinking. They usually know it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors, no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable to drink if we are afraid to face them.
I didn't have ruthless creditors on my list. And I didn't actually have a lot of financial amends to make, except my parents. And when I lived at home when I was in high school, my father kept his wallet on the top of his dresser, and he always had like $100 in it. Or he didn't, you know, I don't think he, it just, my parents were just, we didn't have, they trusted us, you know, they, everybody was supposed to be honest in our house. And I would, I don't know, I don't even remember, a couple times a week I would just take a 20 out of there and go about my way. And again, like, figuring he's not really going to miss it, and I need it, and whatever. I don't even know how, but I just kept doing that for a while. And when I did approach my parents, so this is years later, and I had $200, which I'm thinking probably wasn't enough, but I said I used to do this, and I'm really sorry. I really took advantage of you in many ways, but this is one concrete way. And you know, I have $200, and my mother exploded. She was furious. It wasn't even the money, I realized. It was that betrayal and that sense of that we can't leave, you know, your dad can't leave his wallet on the dresser, you know, in our own home, and that was it. And she actually said, how did you come up with the 200? Like, what you're telling me, it sounds like it's more. And it was just, she just, it really startled me, honestly. It was important for me, because there's something in my ego that wants to think, like, sure, I messed up a little bit, but it didn't really hurt anybody or something. And her reaction was important for me, that it was, I had, you know, really broken trust and betrayed them. And with my mother again, when I was years later, I had a teenage daughter, and we were all visiting, and my daughter was, you know, just acting up and being her age, and I kind of laughed to my mother, and I said, "Wow, so it's payback, you know, like, you know, now I get what it's like to be raising a 16-year-old girl." And I thought she'd kind of chuckle and go like, "Oh yeah, those were the days." And she just started. She said, "That was awful. You were terrible." Now my daughter wasn't even drinking. When I was 16, I was drinking. I was a mess. But and she just started talking about, you know, I was just in Minnesota last week, and she brought up some other stuff. This is a long time ago. She was telling my nephew who was visiting how I used to come home in the front door and say, "Good night, I'm here," and then I'd go out the window or out the door, and I thought, "Well, this is so old. Why are you bringing this kind of stuff up?" But anyway, taking the car, and anyway, so you know, it's a joke now. But so my daughter, when she was 16, that had been a long time since I'd been 16, and again, I went back to my sponsor here, and I said, "Wow, my mom had this reaction when I was talking about, you know, my daughter, and I thought it would be kind of funny in it." And she didn't think it was funny. And she said, "There's work to do there, obviously. There's still wounds there that you need to work on." So I worked with my sponsor, and I thought through some things that she had brought up, but different events. And I called her up, and I said, "You know, you talked about this when I was home a few months ago, and I just wanted to talk about it because, I know I damaged you." And then she said, "Oh, no, I know you need to do that stuff for AA. No, forget about it. No, everything's fine. We're just so happy you're sober. We're so happy you're living a good life." But I said, "No, I was wrong, and I need to make amends for that." And it's just interesting how things come up. My ego tells me I wasn't that bad, because by the last, gosh, I got sober when I was 27, the last six, seven years, I drank by myself, like in whatever room I was renting. I was afraid to go out in public, and I didn't trust myself. I did not drink at weddings. I didn't drink at parties. I drank by myself later because I didn't know where it was going to take me, and I didn't want anybody to see. And so I kind of would think like, "Oh, I'm not really hurting anybody," but I did. I did, and it helps me when people are honest and tell me ways that I hurt them so that I can deal with that.
On the financial amends, I didn't really have a lot of them. Most of my drinking was after I got out of school. I had, was doing really well, and I needed to make financial amends to Mike S. I never did, never saw him again. I would if I ever did see him again. I have Googled his name a few times, but I don't have any way of contacting him, and it's a small amount anyways. I did have to pay off one bar tab at a place called Shifty's. It was one of my favorite bars. And the only other thing is I owed this lawyer for my last drunk driving charge, and I was holding off on paying that, and my sponsor told me, just pay the bill. Other than that, there wasn't, to me, those financial amends are easy anyways, because you just send a check someplace. It's, you don't have to so much face a person, or at least I didn't have to. But it may have been difficult if I had ever run into Mike S. to actually apologize to him and hand him money after he had stolen money from me. I think I would have had a hard time with that, even though I know I needed to do it, because otherwise I'm a thief still.
Page 79, this is our last paragraph. "Although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. Reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience, we ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position, or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything.
Reminding ourselves we need to go to any lengths. This says to find a spiritual experience, and I know for me it's to not drink, which includes, you know, living a spiritual way of life. And whatever the personal consequences may be, we must not drink at anything. What really just motivates me is if I become aware of things that I need, that I've done wrong, that I need to make amends for, I just pray that I will always be willing, because I don't want to drink, and it is the stuff that makes me drink. I pray for the willingness to, you know, be willing to lose my position or reputation or face jail. I hope going forward, I just have to say that I will always be willing, because this is a better way of life and I don't want to lose it. I pass.
What I was saying before about the beginning of the sixth step, and that the eighth step actually is the action for that. That I don't want these character defects anymore. They cause me a lot of harm. The action of steps 1 through 9, what they do is they take and they allow me to identify my character defects and see what they are, exactly what the nature of those are. And then I can put them in a cage. They're still there, but I can put them in a cage where they can't cause me or other people harm. Because I can clearly see what they are, and they're not pretty anymore. And my if I start doing things that I have to make amends for, it means that I'm letting them out of the cage. And I do that from time to time. And before I let them out of the cage, I dress them up in pretty clothes. It's good for my self-esteem, but you know, that's really let my ego out of the cage, yeah. You know, or fear of financial insecurity. You know, it's greed, pure and simple. I put pretty clothes on them before I let them out, you know, so that see, they're presentable. I have a reason to let them out. And then I end up, if I'm having to make amends a lot, it means they're out there. And you know, one thing about my character defects, they don't even get along with each other. they don't, you know, like, you know, sloth tells me not to work, and greed tells me to not only work but to steal from others, you know, and pride says forget about all that, you need to look good, you know, and they don't even get along with each other. So it creates a lot of chaos in my life. And the critical thing for it is after we finish that ninth step, we've got them in a cage, pray. For me, I need to pray to keep them in the cage, to not allow them out. Never start to look at them as though they're pretty again, because if they're pretty, I'm going to let them out and play. It's good to be here.
Thank you. We're going to pass the baskets in accordance with the seventh tradition. The seventh tradition states, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Announcements. Are there any AA announcements? Aaliyah.
My name is Aaliyah and I'm out of the world. Aaliyah. My home group AA 101 at Norfolk Centurion meets Sunday at 11 a.m. We are having our half anniversary, half measures avail us nothing, on June 25th. We're going to have brunch, pancakes, bacon, all that other good stuff. It's going to be a nice spread. We have a speaker named Justin A. He's coming down from Maryland. And from what I hear, he's a good speaker. So we'd like you to join us.
Thanks, Aaliyah. Any other announcements? Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands.
I don't even know what that means. Okay. Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you. Okay. Literature is available on the table to my right. The books are for sale. The brochures are free. Please see me or any home group member after the meeting if you're interested. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Would anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise their hand. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship in AA, I will be available at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to come forward and talk to me. Reminders. Smokers, please use the butt can provided outside. Stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. In closing, can we all thank Mike and Margaret P. again? Thanks to all who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on steps 8 and 9 discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will not be held at Plaza del Sol because they're closed, but it will be held at some other location. Is that right? Okay. And David has volunteered to read the last two paragraphs on page 164.
Everybody, I'm an alcoholic. My name's David.
David.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you could do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thanks, David. We have a nice way of closing.
The power and glory forever and ever.
Amen.
Amen.